Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's first talks between Iran and the United States in Vienna, conducted through Russian, Chinese, and European intermediaries, which resulted in an agreement to create two working groups, one to deal with reviving the nuclear deal and the other to deal with sanctions. Dr. Trita Parsi, the Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and the author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, joins us to discuss his article at the Quincy Institute for True JCPOA Reentry, Biden Must Tear Down This Sanctions Wall. With Iran now only a few months away from having the bomb, there is an urgency among the Europeans, Russians, and Chinese to avert a new war in the Middle East. But Biden's efforts have been booby-trapped by Trump, and he will have to find a way to undo 1,600 extra sanctions imposed by Trump under the guise of terrorism. Meanwhile, there is an undeclared war going on between Iran and Israel, with attacks on tankers shipping oil to Syria and hundreds of airstrikes against Iranian military infrastructure in Syria, which could drag the U.S. back into another quagmire after having wasted $6 trillion in losing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Then we'll examine the difference between treason and insurrection as it applies to the hundreds being charged in the January 6th storming of the Capitol, and speak with one of the nation's leading authorities on the law of treason, Carlton Larson, professor of constitutional law and legal history at the University of California, Davis. The author of On Treason, A Citizen's Guide to the Law and The Trials of Allegiance, Treason, Juries, and the American Revolution, he joins us to discuss the likelihood many among the mob who broke into the Capitol could be charged with seditious conspiracy, which carries a maximum of 20 years in prison. Then finally, we look into the possibility of the Chinese government modernizing its exchange rate arrangements in an effort to get out from under the dominance of the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. An authority on the Chinese economy, Barry Norton, the chair of Chinese International Affairs and a scholar with the 21st Century China program at the University of California, San Diego, joins us to discuss if and when we will have three world currencies, the dollar, the euro, and the renminbi. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, Dr. Trita Parsi, who's Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and a professor of political science at Georgetown University and the co-founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council. His books include Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. And he's the co-author of an article at the Quincy Institute for True JCPOA Reentry, Biden Must Tear Down This Sanctions Wall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it looks as though the concerns that you raised in the article that I just mentioned, Trita, to some extent, it looks as if they've been finessed, because in the meetings today in Vienna, under the auspices, Iran didn't want to meet directly with the United States. So the Iranians have been meeting in a ballroom in a big hotel with diplomats from Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia under the chairmanship of the European Union. And the American delegation led by Robert Malley is in a nearby hotel. So they've been sort of shuttling back and forth, but it seems like they've come up with a way to do two working groups. One working group will focus on how to get Iran back into compliance with the nuclear deal, and the other group will focus on dealing with lifting sanctions. So I take it that you would consider that progress, Ryan?
Yes. I mean, it's clearly a step in the right direction, but we're not even getting close to, you know, some of the really tough issues that lay ahead, because bottom line is that the Trump administration rather cleverly created an extremely difficult situation for all subsequent presidencies, in the sense that almost every sanctions on Iran has been imposed more than once. So even if the nuclear sanctions are lifted by Biden, those same sanctions will continue to exist, but under other authorities, terrorism or something else. And as a result, the lifting of the nuclear version of it is rather meaningless. And this, imagine how challenging it can be for the president to go to Congress and try to explain why he lifted sanctions on Iran that were ostensibly imposed on terrorism grounds.
And indeed, there are 1,600 or so sanctions imposed on Iran during the Trump administration. So that's a pretty heavy lift, Ryan.
That is quite a heavy lift. And, you know, just the time consumption can be quite extensive, in the sense that obviously the Iranians want to make sure that there is movement on the American side on the sanctions before it takes all of its steps. But some of its steps can be completed in 2 months, whereas lifting 1,600 sanctions and making sure that the effect of that lifting is actually present can take quite a bit more time.
Well, I think that was reflected in the by the chairman of these talks, the Russian ambassador to the IAEA, Mikhail Ulyanov. He cautioned to say that the deal will not happen immediately. It will take a long time. How long? Nobody knows. But the other ticking clock is that the U.S. officials now believe that Iran's breakout time to assemble a nuclear weapon is now down to a few months. So there's that going on as well, right?
Absolutely. I mean, as a response to the sanctions that Trump imposed, the Iranians started to reduce their obligations under the deal. So, for instance, they were only supposed to have maximum 400 kilos of LEU on their own soil. You need 1,200 kilos of low-enriched uranium LEU to build a weapon, but they were never allowed to have more than 400 as long as the deal was intact. Trump pulled out of the deal, so the Iranians reduced their obligations, and now I think they're at 2,500 kilos of LEU. This means that their breakout capability has significantly shrunk, and that needs to be addressed. I mean, at least that's the good thing about when it comes to what the Iranians need to do. It's pretty clear what they need to do. There's not a lot of ambiguity, and there's not a lot of confusion on that ground. On the American side, it's a little bit trickier, because of this deliberate minefield of sanctions that the Trump administration deliberately created in order to make any return towards the JCPOA next to impossible.
But they didn't work, did they? That's the bottom line. I mean, they were incredibly punitive, but Iran has not buckled. Obviously, they desperately want to get out from under them. But what was the purpose of imposing these extra sanctions? What did Kushner and Netanyahu and Trump, what were they trying to achieve?
They were trying to achieve what we're seeing today, which is that the Biden administration is going to have a really hard time going back into the deal because of the difficulty of lifting all of those extra 1,600 sanctions. These sanctions were not there because they thought this adds leverage to the United States. They were not there because they thought that this actually strengthens U.S. negotiation position. These sanctions were added to make sure that there wouldn't be any negotiations, that there wouldn't be any return. And in fact, they said so. I mean, they explicitly said, we're doing it in such a way to make it extra difficult to reverse them. Well, if you do something and you want to make sure that you cannot be reversed, then by definition, you have not designed this to be leverage, because leverage is only there if you have the ability to impose it and lift it. Because otherwise, you're telling a country, it doesn't matter what you do, these sanctions are going to stay in place. Well, then it's not leverage. The only way you can get leverage if you can say to them, well, if you change your behavior on X, Y, and Z, we can and will lift these sanctions. They have designed these sanctions not to be liftable. So they're not leveraged. They're there to sabotage diplomacy.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, the Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and a Professor of Political Science at Georgetown University and the co-founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council. His latest book is Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. And he's a co-author of an article at the Quincy Institute for True JCPOA Reentry, Biden Must Tear Down This Sanctions Wall. But there is, of course, going on a kind of low-intensity, undeclared, low-level war in the shadows between Israel and Iran. And there's no question that Kushner was just an extension of Netanyahu, this Abraham's Accords. Everything that Trump did in what is loosely called diplomacy vis-a-vis the Middle East was all basically done by Netanyahu and through Kushner being basically almost like a stenographer. But in the real world, there's been these low-level attacks. And there was an explosion at an Iranian centrifuge assembly plant in July of 2020. Iran's nuclear weapons architect, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was killed in November of 2020. And there have been a series of incidents between February and March this year, explosions aboard Iranian oil tankers in the Mediterranean en route to Syria, and a deliberate oil leak by an Iranian tanker off the Israeli coast, which actually impacted the southern Lebanon and a nature reserve. And there has also been suspected Iranian attacks on Israeli-owned commercial ships in the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. So this is going on at the same time. So, Trita, I don't understand what Netanyahu's and Trump's and Kushner's strategy is here. Do you want the Iranians to get a nuclear weapon? Because as long as they're out from under the JCPOA, as you just pointed out, they've got enough low-enriched uranium now. So what is the logic of what Netanyahu is up to?
It's quite interesting because as the Biden administration is now making clear that the Iranian breakout capability has shrunk to 3 to 4 months, the Israelis are coming out with the opposite. They're saying, no, it's now 2 to 3 years, which is, of course, mathematically impossible unless you've decided to just completely change the formula. So the Israelis are coming out and saying this because they don't want pressure on the U.S. to do anything diplomatically. They want to reduce that pressure. And when it comes to what their end game here is, I think what they're really shooting for is that if the Iranian nuclear program is unchecked, at some point the United States will end up having to take military action against Iran. And they prefer that because it brings with it all kinds of other benefits. One benefit is that a strike against Iran is not going to be limited to the nuclear program, but it would actually be much more punitive and target a lot of Iran's other conventional capabilities. So having the United States bomb Iran extensively is going to shift the balance of power in the region in a way that the Israelis or the Netanyahu government at least believes it's favorable to it. Moreover, it will dramatically reduce any chances of any type of a warm-up in the relations between the United States and Iran, which again is what the Netanyahu government believes is in interests. It does not want to see an improved relationship between the U.S. and Iran. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, it will ensure that the United States remains militarily committed and present in the region for the foreseeable future. This is the most important thing. The Israelis do not want to see the United States leave the Middle East militarily, nor do the Saudis or the Emiratis. They enjoy and benefit from the security umbrella that America's military attempt at hegemony in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East establishes for them, and they do not want to see that change. Because if the U.S. were to leave militarily, they calculate, the balance will shift away from them, and they themselves do not have the capacity of upholding the current balance. It's only there because of the manner in which the United States, an extra-regional power, is present in the region militarily with more than 50,000 troops. So a military confrontation between the United States and Iran over the nuclear issue, I think from Netanyahu's perspective, secures a whole set of different objectives.
Well, I think it's always been clear that Israel doesn't have the military capability to take out these hardened sites that the Iranians have, and that they want to start the war, but they want America to finish the war by using its more powerful military assets. But that would drag the United States into a very long war. And Iran and Russia, of course, are both backing the Assad regime. The Israelis have had hundreds of strikes against Iranian infrastructure there. They don't want the Iranians to build up a bridgehead in Syria. So that's another part of this low-level war that's going on. The Chinese are a major purchaser of Iranian oil. They could be dragged into the situation of having to militarily escort their tankers. So is that why Russia and China are behaving as responsible partners here in brokering these talks? Because they actually don't want a war on the Middle East.
I think it's very clear that the Russians and the Chinese do not want to see a military confrontation in the Middle East. If you're sitting in Russia, that type of instability can reach you in a way that is very detrimental. If you're sitting in Beijing and you know that 40% of your energy is coming from the Persian Gulf, war will create market instability, rise of prices, but also spillover effects that are very, very dangerous. Same thing is true for the Europeans. We have seen how the previous wars have created massive refugee flows that have had a profound impact on the politics of Europe, at least. And we should keep in mind that a very, 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 very small level of those refugees ever reached the United States. So the United States, insulated by two major oceans, really do not see the repercussions of these wars in the Middle East in the same manner that the Russians, the Chinese, and the Europeans do.
So, is Biden, does he have the support necessary here? You were saying earlier, Trita Parsi, how difficult it's going to be for Biden to lift these 1,600 sanctions that Trump imposed after the JCPOA. So, it's not just a question of lifting the sanctions from the JCPOA, but lifting all these extra ones. And the Trump administration have booby-trapped them by placing them under the rubric of terrorism. So, what kind of support does Biden have here?
It all depends on the type of a groundwork that he does to get that support. So far, none of it has been made because his focus has been on domestic issues. The messaging has not been prepared for such a big move. And as a result, it's impossible to tell. If you were to go right now to Congress and ask for it, I'm sure it would not necessarily be the easiest of ask. But if the proper deliberations are done and preparations and the public messaging and the briefings on the Hill, everything else that is needed to be able to convince key elements there that this is the right move, then I do definitely believe that he has a chance of succeeding. One thing we should keep in mind is that when Barack Obama managed to sell the deal to Congress in 2015, it was a deal that had not been tested. So he was really asking a lot of members of Congress to stick out their necks and give him a chance, give the deal a chance. That is not the situation right now. Now we have 6 years of experience in which we know that the deal works. We know that the Iranians lived up to their end of the bargain. And we know what happens when the US pulled out. It's a much worse situation. So the ability to sell this, I think, is profoundly better now than it was 6 years ago. It doesn't mean that it won't be difficult, but it means that the type of risk that some members of Congress felt that they were asked to take is simply not the case any longer.
But just in closing, Dr. Trita Parsi, do you think it would be wise for Obama to have a discussion along the lines of what we were just talking about a minute ago, which is what the real subtext here is, that the US has a tremendously painful recent history of fruitless engagements in this region with Afghanistan, which is an ongoing disaster, and then you've got Iraq, and then all of the chips that fell from the US invasion of Iraq. So the American public have wasted something like $6 trillion on these fruitless wars. So I think, and in fact, ironically, Trump to some extent ran on that platform. Let's get out, you know. But now you're telling us that no, that's the opposite is true, that the Kushner-Trump Netanyahu deal is to make sure the Americans stay in there to protect MBS, this creep, this murderous little creep that runs Saudi Arabia, and Netanyahu and the Emiratis. I mean, can we just put that to the American people? Do you want to keep supporting this crowd for the rest of the millennium? Or do you want to refocus America's strategies to more important areas like China?
I personally believe that it was a mistake by the Obama administration not to make this argument back in 2015. And, you know, in retrospect, perhaps it wasn't needed back then. But I think today, I think it is important to level with the American people that the nuclear deal with Iran is the ticket for the United States to be able to leave the region militarily. We need to check the Iranian nuclear program in order for us to be able to check out from the Middle East in the military sense. I'm not talking about an end of diplomatic relations or an end of trade or anything like that. I'm talking about having 19 bases in the region, 58,000 troops plus in the region. Those things are not needed. They're not adding to American security, on the contrary. And whatever interest the United States has in the region, it can achieve without having that type of a military presence. I think this is important because I think it's also a way of getting folks on the right to be more supportive of the JCPOA because it's become such a partisan issue. But if more people on the right understood that this is actually a necessary step in order to be able to achieve what they, to a very large extent, agree with, which is the United States should not be in these endless wars in the region. It should not endlessly police the region, which is the reason why it is in these endless wars, and that the deal is necessary in order to be able to get out of that situation, I think you would start to see some shifts on the Republican side on this issue. And again, you don't need all Republicans to jump ship. You just need to be able to have some of them shift their position. And I think this is an argument that is far more receptive, that they are far more receptive to than many of the other arguments that the Biden or the Obama administration put forward. And it does, of course, have the very added benefit of being absolutely true.
Well, Dr. Tridipasi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who's Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and a Professor of Political Science at Georgetown University and the co-founder and former President of the National Iranian American Council. And his latest book is Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. And he's the co-author of an article at the Quincy Institute for True JCPOA Reentry, Biden Must Tear Down This Sanctions Wall. We're going to take a restation break and back examining the difference between treason and insurrection as it applies to the hundreds being charged in the January 6th storming of the Capitol. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Carlton Larson, who's a professor of constitutional law and legal history at the University of California, Davis, one of the nation's leading authorities on the law of treason. He's the author of the books On Treason, A Citizen's Guide to the Law, and The Trials of Allegiance, Treason, Juries, and the American Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carlton Larson.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So we know that the Founding Fathers were quite concerned about treason. Benedict Arnold and these characters come up in history. But my understanding is that, well, let's just go back to you yourself, Carlton. Apparently, during the Trump administration, according to an article in The Guardian, why aren't we calling the Capitol attack an act of treason? It's mentioned here that you had spent a lot of time throughout the Trump administration on the phone with journalists who were questioning Trump's loyalty to the United States and his fealty to, particularly to Putin, suggesting, no, it's not treason. But since January the 6th, or after January the 6th, I take it you consider what happened on January the 6th to be treason. Is that right?
Well, I think it's safe to say that what happened on January 6th would have been viewed as treason by the people who drafted the definition of treason that we have in our Constitution. If you look at what they said at the time and how they responded to arguably similar internal rebellions, such as the Whiskey Rebellion or the Freezes Rebellion, they thought that armed rebellions with the intent of obstructing the operation of federal law was treason against the United States. Where it gets a little complicated is there's some later case law from the mid-19th century that suggests you might have to have the intent to overthrow the government completely rather than just obstruct the operation of one particular law. So one of the issues that makes this complicated is what exactly the January 6 rioters were trying to do. Were they just trying to obstruct the operation of the Electoral Count Act, or were they really in some way trying to overthrow the entire United States government?
Well, isn't it pretty clear that they wanted to stop the count in order to keep Trump in the White House? I mean, I don't think there's much ambiguity about that, is there? I mean, whether it would work or not is another matter. So how does it
Yeah.
work? Intent or results?
Well, it's intent, because obviously most of these things are doomed to fail, as was this one. But where it gets tricky is that, you know, Trump was the sitting president, and so arguably you're not trying to overturn anybody who's currently in power. You're trying to obstruct the operation of what would go forward on January 20th, and that's where it potentially gets a little messy. And that's why I suspect prosecutors would not, at the end of the day, view this as a type of case that would be appropriate for a treason charge, because there's so many other crimes that these people committed that don't raise these kinds of legal complexities. And so I suspect we'll see prosecutors pursuing those types of charges.
Well, I think there's been an indication from the outgoing U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia who went on 60 Minutes against DOJ policy and brought up the possibility of charging a lot of these people who stormed the Capitol with insurrection. So, what's the difference then, Carlton, between treason and insurrection?
Well, I think the statute he was referring to was the seditious conspiracy statute, which requires essentially a conspiracy of two or more people to, and the language includes, oppose by force the authority of the United States government, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States. Well, that's exactly what they were doing. They were delaying the execution of the Electoral Count Act by force. Or it says by force to seize, take, or possess property of the United States. Well, they were clearly possessing the United States Capitol. So I think that statute fits pretty clearly with what they did. And I would expect that, you know, as the prosecutor suggested, even if he was speaking out of turn, that that's almost certainly a charge that will be filed against some of the participants.
And again, I'm speaking with Carlton Larson, who's Professor of Constitutional Law and Legal History at the University of California, Davis. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on the law of treason, and he's the author of the books On Treason, A Citizen's Guide to the Law, and The Trials of Allegiance, Treason, Juries, and the American Revolution. So there's more than 300 people who are being charged, and many of them belong to the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, etc. There may well be more cases. At the end of the day, do you have any sense of what kind of volume there will be here? I mean, just in terms of the law, everybody that entered the Capitol on that day broke the law, did they not?
Yes, that's true. So I think at minimum, everybody who participated in that could be charged with trespass. And so my sense from what you see in terms of them trying to track down photos of people is they really do want to identify every single person who was involved in this. And I think it would be appropriate for every single person to be charged with at least some crime. I think that, you know, the more difficult problem is, you know, fitting the particular crime to each person, and that's going to be issues of evidence, issues of you know, prosecutorial resources. And so I suspect there'll be a handful of people who will be singled out for the most extensive and most serious charges, and then there will probably be some people who may receive ultimately fairly a minor sentence for what they did.
So in terms of the major censuses, for those that were fairly visible, you know, perhaps the guy with the coyote headdress and the horns, although apparently his mental stability is questionable, the maximum penalty for seditious conspiracy is 20 years. So do you expect those kind of sentences? Because surely it's important for the health of this country to make an example of these people, because they thought they were patriots. And there are many of them still out there that supported what happened and that participated in what happened. And many of them are heavily armed and ready to do it again. So isn't this a situation where some punishment is needed in the form of deterrence against further attacks?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think you just can't look at an event like this and just say, okay, you get a pass, or you get a do-over, or we're just going to sort of shrug our heads and forget about this. So I absolutely support prosecution of all of these people. As you noted, the seditious conspiracy, probably the most serious charge, would have a maximum of 20 years in prison. That could probably be negotiated down by plea bargaining. I would expect a 20-year sentence would probably emerge only if somebody took the case to trial and then lost, and then the judge did impose that highest sentence. But I suspect the number of people who would actually come out of this with a full 20-year sentence would probably be fairly low. But even something like a 10-year sentence is a pretty strong sentence, and I would hope a deterrent to this kind of behavior in the future.
So are there any examples of people being charged with seditious conspiracy?
There have been a handful of cases recently. The probably the most prominent was the people who were engaged in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. They were charged under the seditious conspiracy statute. And there was another case, I think, in the early 2010s from Michigan against a militia group. So there's a handful of cases. It's not something that is charged a whole lot. It's not a crime that necessarily happens a whole lot, and it's not one that federal prosecutors probably have a lot of deep experience working with. And, you know, I think fortunately that's a good thing. You know, if we had this type of thing happening all the time, we'd be in a world of hurt as a country.
So back to the first question I asked, which is based upon the article in The Guardian that quotes you from the beginning, why aren't we calling the Capitol attack an act of treason, how you were getting lots of questions from reporters about Trump's potential for treason because of his peculiar relationship with Putin. If it were to be proven, because it's still, I mean, we know from what happened with the Mueller report that immediately after Trump fired Comey, the FBI started to look into a counterintelligence investigation of Trump himself. That was ongoing. And then when the Mueller probe began, Rod Rosenstein, without telling anybody, without telling the FBI, he killed that counterintelligence investigation. And it was never really a part of the Mueller writ. But I've talked to a lot of counterintelligence people, including one of the guys that Trump has targeted, Peter Strzok. And interesting enough, Trump has targeted all of the top counterintelligence people in the FBI, particularly those that dealt with Russian organized crime and with Russia. They've all been purged largely. So my understanding is in the counterintelligence files, you do have enough evidence to charge Trump with treason. What would it take under the statutes? What kind of smoking gun? There's a lot of smoke, obviously, but if you could actually come up with some fire, what would be required?
Yeah, so obviously his behavior with respect to the counterintelligence investigation is absolutely deplorable, and there should have been a good, thorough counterintelligence investigation of Trump. But the reality is, even if they came up with the smokingest of smoking guns, I mean, they came up with an agreement, say a written agreement between Trump and Putin, where Trump said he would take every order from Vladimir Putin. That still wouldn't actually constitute treason against the United States. And that's because for it to be treason by aiding the enemy, it has to be a nation with whom we're in a state of open war. And we just aren't in that state with Russia. And so that means that lots of behavior is that the most extraordinary betrayal of the United States you can possibly imagine. You know, handing military secrets over to China or to Germany or any other country in the world, really, generally is not going to be treason unless we are actually at war with that country. And for all the back and forth with Russia, we just aren't in that state of war. Now, fortunately, there are a ton of other crimes that could be brought under, and espionage would probably be one of the most likely, but it wouldn't technically be treason.
Well, what about seditious conspiracy?
It could be that. I mean, it would depend on the facts. If Trump had an agreement to essentially try to overthrow the United States government by force, I'm not sure that one would necessarily find that. But who knows what one could find? It would very much depend on the particular facts.
Well, there are some rumors that this investigation is zeroing in on, particularly on Roger Stone, on Stephen Bannon, who the day before January the 6th said all hell is going to break loose tomorrow. Roger Stone apparently went down to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Trump before this rally was held that Trump spoke at and directed the crowd towards the Capitol. So if it were shown that Trump actually not just sort of inspired this, but actually planned it and was in many ways the leader of the seditious conspiracy, it could come out of these investigations. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a possibility. I mean, if all Trump did was give a sort of incendiary speech on the Ellipse, it wouldn't fit the seditious conspiracy statute. But if he had been planning the attack ahead of time, working with people to make this happen, then yes, I think that would be a good fit for a seditious conspiracy.
And what about, for example, Congressman Paul Gosar? It's rumored that he was one of the congresspeople that shepherded a group of the people that showed up, you know, either the following day or a few days later on January the 6th, storming the Capitol, in effect giving the conspirators a reconnaissance tour of the Capitol. And, of course, interestingly enough, Congressman Mo Brooks, who spoke at the rally that Trump spoke at, and Congressman Andy Biggs, they both asked Trump for a pardon before he left office, and he didn't give it to them. But the fact that they asked for a pardon would indicate that maybe they are also involved, as it is rumored that Paul Gosar is involved. So if these congresspeople are held to account for guiding these tours of the insurrectionists before January the 6th or having their staff do it, would they be open to charges of seditious conspiracy?
It would really depend on what they knew. I mean, if they did it with the deliberate intent that they were, you know, offering essentially a map to the Capitol and doing so with the intent that these people would storm the Capitol and do what they did, then I think potentially, yes, that might fit the seditious conspiracy statute as well. If all you have is evidence that they gave the tour, that's probably not going to be enough. And indicting a sitting member of Congress for a seditious conspiracy would be one of the most significant steps the Department of Justice could ever take. And so I wouldn't expect them to do that unless they had, you know, absolute rock-solid evidence showing that these people knew exactly what they were doing, and they did so with the intent that this would happen.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Carlton Larson.
Oh, sure. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And again, I've been speaking with Carlton Larson, who's a professor of constitutional law and legal history at the University of California, Davis, one of the nation's leading authorities on the law of treason. He's the author of the books On Treason, A Citizen's Guide to the Law, and The Trials of Allegiance, Treason, Juries, and the American Revolution. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the possibility of the Chinese government modernizing its exchange rate arrangements in an effort to get out from under the dominance of the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Barry Norton, who's the So Kwan Lok Chair in Chinese International Affairs and a scholar with the 21st Century China Program at the University of California, San Diego, an authority on the Chinese economy. He has recently focused on Chinese trade and technology in particular, and the relationship between the development of the electronics industry in China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and the growth of trade and investment among these economies. And his books include The China Circle, Economics and Technology in the PRC, Taiwan and Hong Kong, The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth. And his latest book is State Capitalism, Institutional Adaptation, and the Chinese Miracle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barry Norton.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Barry. And do you think that we are fast approaching a moment when the world's appetite for the dollar and for dollar debt, which appears to be insatiable at the moment and has been for some time? In other words, do you think the dominance of the greenback, its days may be numbered as the Chinese now modernize their international monetary order and their exchange rate regime? So where do we stand? Because, you know, as we know, Barry, Biden is running up massive debts, which we can do because we are the reserve currency. And whether the Europeans or the Chinese or the Japanese, whoever, they don't like it. But we can basically, the Fed can write pretty much a blank check. So, and we know we've had $1.9 trillion in the first tranche. Now there's $2.3 in the next, and so forth. So if China's reserve currency along with the euro were challenging the dollar, it wouldn't be so easy for Biden to borrow this kind of money, right?
That's absolutely right. And so if you're thinking about long-term challenges, this should definitely go up on your list. We're talking about sort of tectonic shifts in the underlying structure of the global economy. And so that's something we should worry about as a part of concerns about the American economy and the stability of our recovery and the excessive debt and things like that. But I would say if you've got a lot of things to worry about this week, maybe this should not be one of the things you would worry about this week, because this is something that's going to happen over a pretty long time span. And it's not even 100% sure that it's going to happen at all. If you'd like, I could start with sort of two very sort of surprising, perhaps, and indisputable facts. And then on the basis of that, we could talk about whether these things are likely to change. Does that sound right?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. So, I mean, the first fact is the remarkable dominance of the U.S. dollar. I mean, the dollar is king, right, in the world economy. While the U.S. GDP is just under a quarter of world GDP, the dollar is used in 88% of all foreign exchange transactions. In other words, it's any time a currency is swapped with another currency, the dollar is one of them in 88% of all exchanges. And the U.S. dollar is about 60% of foreign exchange reserves and international debt and things like that. While China is 2%. And of course, this dollar dominance gives the U.S. power, influence, and visibility along with the other things that give the U.S. power. And of course, it means it's much easier, as you started us out with, it's much easier for us to finance our debt. So the second indisputable thing is China doesn't like this one bit. China's economy, after all, is not that much smaller than the U.S. It is still smaller, but it's growing faster, and it's already the biggest trading economy, significantly bigger than the United States. So Chinese leaders bridle at this U.S. dollar dominance. and they clearly are taking steps to try to reduce it. One thing they're doing is they're setting up their own international payments network. That is a system, electronic system for foreign exchange transactions, along with, guess who? Russia and Iran. So in other words, the idea is that initially these three countries, but later more certainly, would be able to trade and exchange money without worrying about U.S. sanctions and perhaps without the visibility of the U.S. into their transactions. And the second thing they've done, this especially fascinating, they've already established a blockchain version of their own currency. In other words, it's a Chinese Bitcoin issued by the Chinese government, which could make it cheaper and easier to use the Chinese currency. And it's already in trial use in China. They have already started to use it to make transactions. So definitely there's a set of underlying conditions which are sort of ripe for change.
And you're referring to the People's Bank of China issuing these digital currency?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. So, but at this point, in terms of foreign exchange, China's still pegging the renminbi to a basket of currencies. And that is the current situation, right? And the dollar, of course, is, as you mentioned, is the anchor currency for roughly most of the world's GDP. So what kind of time frame are we talking about here? If the Chinese government are bribing against the hegemony of the dollar, I mean, in other words, if it's just limited to them trading with Russia and Iran in the renminbi, right, or whatever, when are they going to break out?
Right. So that's a great question. And the honest answer is nobody knows. Because here's a sort of paradox that underlies the whole thing. First of all, you can't force people to use your currency, right? I mean, you can force your own citizens to use it and put up barriers to other monies, but that only goes so far, even for a giant country like China. And so in the rest of the world, people have a choice. And right now, it's quite clear what the choice is. They will choose dollars, and they should choose dollars, because dollars are cheaper and they're safer. It's cheaper to borrow in dollars. It's cheaper to transfer dollars to other currencies. You know the United States is not going to expropriate you. And so, you know, it's just better to use dollars. Now, could it change? Yeah, it could change. But in a way, that depends on the Chinese government making it more desirable to hold the Chinese currency by relaxing its control, right? First of all, by letting capital flow in and out, and second of all, by letting the value of the Chinese currency, the renminbi, be determined by the market. If they can start to successfully and stably let control, and they are doing some interesting things in that direction, then the strength of the Chinese economy will start to flow through into the Chinese currency and could start to challenge U.S. dollar dominance.
And again, I'm speaking with Barry Norton, who's the chair of Chinese International Affairs and scholar with the 21st Century China Program at the University of California, San Diego, and an authority on the Chinese economy. His books include The China Circle, Economics and Technology in the PRC, Taiwan and Hong Kong, The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth, and his latest book is State Capitalism, Institutional Adaptation, and the Chinese Miracle. So if you look at historical examples, Barry, up to the end of the 19th century, the British pound dominated the world's it was the world's reserve currency and dominated trade. Then, I guess, through the period with World War One, and then all the way through to World War Two, that's when the dollar gradually took over. But that was several decades we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was quite a gradual transition. So, I mean, it's funny, there's sort of two lessons that could be learned from that. I mean, one is that there is a tendency for one currency to be dominant, because if you're using it for, you know, two out of three things or three out of four things, then it's going to dominate because you might as well use it for everything. But the other lesson is there are gradual changes that take place that move this. It's not immutable. And so I think you and I started talking because of an article by Ken Rogoff in The Guardian suggesting, wait a minute, maybe China is moving enough that they might start to attract other Asian countries into a renminbi block. And that's really interesting to think about. And of course, Rogoff relates this to the period in the 1970s and 80s when Europe, which had been especially reliant on the dollar in the immediate post-war period, started to move towards a currency system focused on the German mark and then ultimately the euro. And of course, now we have the euro and the dollar as major currency players. Unlike the renminbi, the euro is really important. It's not nearly as important as the dollar, but it's still very, very important in its own sphere, accounting for, you know, roughly a third of world currency activity. And so what Rogoff suggests is, hey, wait a minute, maybe we're getting to the point where Asia will start to come together in currency terms in the same way that Europe did in the 70s and 80s. So it's really something worth thinking about, but it's a long, long process. We probably be talking about 20 or 30 years, but, you know, this is a new world and money is changing, right? Since Bitcoin, money might be changing. And so possibly these things will happen faster than we would otherwise expect.
Right, and the Chinese economy is booming. We've been here in the United States with COVID paralyzing us, and the economy's been at a standstill for the longest time. It's ironic that the COVID began in China, and yet they were able to deal with it quickly and effectively, and we are still walled in. We talk about building walls. We're walled in here. And we're about to, I think, go through an even worse period from what epidemiologists are telling us. So let's talk a little bit about politics versus the economy. How could the Chinese make strides in terms of getting their currency to be the world reserve currency? At the same time, politically, you've got the U.S. now moving in creating what they call the Quad, with India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. It's not an overt alliance against China, but it's an implied alliance against China. So
that's absolutely right.
So when you were talking about the idea that you could have a euro equivalent in Asia, I can't see the Japanese getting aboard that at this moment politically.
No, that's absolutely right. You can't see the Japanese. You could conceivably see Korea sign up. But remember that countries don't necessarily have to do this formally. It's more a question of whether they start to think of their currencies as being more stable vis-a-vis the Chinese currency than it is vis-a-vis the dollar. It starts to be in their advantage to make contracts that are denominated in Chinese currency instead of contracts that are denominated in dollars. Here's the thing. What we see today is China taking some steps in that direction, in addition to the things I mentioned earlier, that are actually pretty savvy and are very surprising because they involve letting go of some control. And so one area where they've been quite successful is enticing foreign investors to buy Chinese government bonds. There are quite a lot of Chinese government bonds, and they have a pretty high interest rate. And they're backed by the Chinese government, which, although it's, we have a lot of conflicts with the Chinese government, and there are a lot of things where their practices are harmful or at least controversial. But their credit is pretty darn good. And so they've been opening up this bond market, and money has been flowing in to buy Chinese government bonds. Now, of course, right now, it's still a relatively small amount in terms of the total global financial markets, but a small amount in terms of global financial markets is still hundreds of billions of dollars. And so that's starting this process. And it shows that at least in certain areas, at least when they're under pressure from the United States, the Chinese can still move forward with market opening measures if they think it's really in their interest to do so.
So just in the last couple of minutes, how long do you think it'll be, Barry, before China's middle class is as big as the entire population of the United States? We also have currently the phenomenon of Chinese tourism around the world. And I'm wondering at what point they will be having not so much American Express dollars, but their own currency as they travel abroad.
Well, it's already happening. I mean, if you look closely, if you go to, say, Florence, Italy, and you look closely, you'll see little signs that say that Chinese credit cards are accepted in almost all the stores. Now, that's not a separate transaction network, but the world is definitely adjusting to the size of the Chinese economy and the size of the Chinese middle class, which by some definitions is already as big as the American middle class. It's not as rich as the American middle class, but just in terms of size, it is already as big. So, you know, here's the paradox. China's monetary influence will expand more rapidly if the Chinese government persists in letting go of control of financial transactions. But, you know, the Chinese government's really not very good at letting go of control.
Going in the opposite direction, frankly. Exactly, under Xi Jinping, exactly. It's going in the opposite direction.
So there's this paradox at the heart of this. And you see it in the financial realm. Here the Chinese government cracked down on Alibaba's financial subsidiary, Ant Financial, said, no, you can't list on the stock market because we're going to crimp the ease with which you access capital markets and borrow. But behind that was really, we want the government to be in control and have visibility of these financial transactions. Can it combine that with a greater openness and hands-off attitude toward international capital flows? It's never been tried before in history, so it's something we're going to be watching closely, but I think it's too early to know whether they're going to succeed at this.
Well, Barry Norton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure talking to you. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Barry Norton, who's the chair of Chinese International Affairs and a scholar with the 21st Century China Program at the University of California, San Diego, an authority on the Chinese economy. His books include The China Circle, Economics and Technology in the PRC, Taiwan and Hong Kong, The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth, and his latest book, State Capitalism, Institutional Adaptation, and The Chinese Miracle. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Stay